Listen for a moment to this statement. What is the use of reading the common news of the day, the tragic deaths and abuses of daily living, when for half a lifetime we have known that they must have occurred just as they have occurred, given the conditions that caused them? There is no light in it. It is trivial fill gap. We know the plane will crash, the train derail, and we know why. No one cares, no one can care. We get the news and discount it. We are quite right in doing so. That's William Carlos Williams, 1951, from an essay called The Practice. Now listen for a moment to this one. There's something elegiac in the whole fabric of our time about which I can do nothing. The time in which I am born is something done to me. It creates a particular style of thought and a particular violation of the self about which one can do nothing. The time in which anyone is born is a violation done to him. That's Larry, about 30 years later. Both of those poets seem to be telling us that between the experience of an actual life lived and the public narratives that are offered to explain and give a sense to that life, there is an enormous gap. The desolation and the sadness occurs in the space between. And some of us will do anything to fill that gap. We will follow our politicians to wherever. We will follow the media to wherever. Anything to fill that space between a life which is increasingly isolated and alone and all of this noise on the outside. But that gap is also an impetus for poetry. Poems come from an experience which need the poems to comprehend that experience. It occurs in language, and it occurs in astonishment, and that's what Larry was all about. It was about that astonishment. It's kind of a miracle when it occurs. It's an addictive thing. You want to go back and experience it again and again, and that joy in the language more than anything else, the recognition comes in the writing, is what Larry was about. So when you tell me that I've won the Larry Levis Prize, given my preoccupations, I want you to know that it means a great deal to me, and I promise you that I'm going to use the energy that comes from this, which is very palpable to me, to continue doing my work. All kinds of poets win prizes, good, bad, indifferent, mediocre, but this is very, very special to me. I'm going to go on now and read to you some poems from my book. This book has had a fortunate little life for the last year and a half, and I've had the chance to read, but tonight I'm going to read some new poems too. But I'm going to start off with a poem called Writing Off Argentina. As David said, I am a business guy. That's how I make my living. And I did go to Argentina in December of 2000, just before I left my job to go home to write for 18 months. And this poem is called Writing Off Argentina. This morning, the peso is free-floating above the unstable world of Borges. He knew Buenos Aires was not a city to die in. Geneva was that much closer to the other world. When the system fails, the theory of the system becomes pure, and the housewives of Buenos Aires gather outside Congress and bang their pots and pans, and their husbands gather outside the courthouse and jangle their car keys, proudly to ask, "What have you done to our good life?" Brazilian joke. Why do Argentines run outdoors when there's lightning? Because they think God is taking their photograph. Borges asked, what man has never felt that he has lost something infinite? When the economy falls apart, you feel that loss. Plus your pesos deflate to illustrate. Yesterday on the Avenida Borges, we lived in this world. But what were we like? We took our dollars to buy leather coats at the shop of Esteban Umansky, who gave each of us a hat and gloves. The president himself attended our reception, and the ex-president, now under house arrest for the millions in his Swiss account. So the Argentines go to Switzerland to hoard and die, and we go to Buenos Aires to shop and live. When Borges went to Geneva to die, the Argentines thought it was some kind of poetic conceit. They were too cocky to see. He had given up trying to express himself. Something great had been lost, some treasure. He had decided all men are benighted. This morning of the wrecked and plundered, I am all-seeing, but my soul is blind. I feel very much like myself. In pursuit of a deal in leather, in pursuit of one's money in the shuttered banks, we are forgetting how to be decently unhappy. Learn from the global lenders, writing off their bad Argentine debts. Their dual wisdom, first, understanding the loss, then, understanding there's nothing to be done. I understand, and I love my odorous coat. And Esteban made me a jacket as well, at a price not to be believed. I remember in high school, my English teacher defining poetry, she would say, you know, Wordsworth said, poetry is emotion recollected in tranquility. But Wordsworth never said that. He didn't say that. He said that the origins of poetry are to be found in emotion recollected in tranquility, the origins, which means that you start with memory, but you move from memory. I think Greg also just touched on that. So I went to Argentina on business, and it was a year and a half later that I wrote this poem. And in the writing of poetry, you get the insight into what the experience was about. Otherwise, there's no need to write a poem. That's the problem, ultimately, with, as Louise Glick has said, with confessional poetry. If I confess something to you that I know, and I put it in a poem, it may make me feel better. I got it off my chest. But I already knew. I had already discovered the significance of it. There's nothing new. It might be titillating to you. But there's no point in my writing it because I've discovered nothing in the writing of the poem. This next piece is called Light Fingers, and it's about growing up. It's about my youth in Quincy, Massachusetts. I was born there in 1950. Oh, I should say, too, my dad was in, he was a liquor retailer. Light fingers. Feather duster in a child's grip swished over bottles of old granddad in my father's liquor store. My hand hovering briefly above rolls of coin in the cash drawer. Other objects stolen from local merchants, a magnifying glass, a high-low thermometer, an Indian rubber baseball, novelties, candy, cigarettes. If you wouldn't give me what I deserved, what you seemed to promise, then I would take it from you. The splendor of scissors, the consideration of a rubber stamp for your attention. At some point, after the accumulation of the objects of desire, and later after they became unforgettable, beyond understanding and useless, this is when I looked back and saw the boy making a daring effort to be part of the family's sadness. All of the grief that preceded me, war, fire, the destruction of culture, the powerlessness of parents, the compensations of shameful inward lives, this, I perceived, is simply what it means to be human. So now there is nothing to rest into myself, for myself, but there is the spirit leaping with dread and exultation, demanding everything, and the old cunning. When Mrs. O'Brien suggested that Joseph, her son, and I go to see his priest about our common venal behavior, my mother, a Holocaust survivor, threw her out of the house. I returned to my favorite pastime, a book of sleight of hand tricks, small objects, all objects, vanishing. I did write poetry in the 70s and into the early 80s, but I wrote no poetry for almost 20 years, from the early 80s until 2001. My father-in-law died in March of 01. I started writing again in June of 01, and I quit my job and went home. I'd worked in that last job for 7 years. I had some money in the bank, and I went home to write. I went from writing nothing to a kind of graphomania, you know, where everything looks like a poem. That went on for 3 or 4 months, and suddenly there was a stack of poems there. I really had no expectations of making a book or being able to come here and to talk to you, but I went through a process where I finally learned something about revising work and about going back as you revise to the original inspiration of the poem and not being afraid to look the reader in the eye, not be afraid to make declarative statements, not to rely just on attitude. I work with someone now, I show her all of my work, and she tells me all my bad habits, and my bad habits don't change. They're always the same, but now I know what they are. So I can get a draft down and then go back and do the pruning that I need to do. One of the poems that was revised quite a bit is this poem called Apparition of the Virgin. If there's a crack of thunder without an attending rumble, a great man is about to die. If, in your dreams, your clothes are flecked with mud, or if a plant speaks to you, expect days when love inhabits you, but is not apparent in the world, even as others pause to let you pass, attempting to be visible in your presence. When the main god is a martyr, the world is in pain. We're mirthful in the bistro, tasting each other's dinners, since we suspect the taste of our own. Later, we drive to get a good look at the apparition of the Virgin. She's appearing in a window at the hospital, moisture trapped between panes. We can clearly see the baby in her arms, the folds of her robe, the hem indistinct with dirt. Along the foundation of the wall, prayers. Please make my parents stop fighting. Please save the missing children. If you dream of rain, and on awaking it is August, expect days of wine that create visions. The grapes are swelling beyond themselves. Expect images wavering in the rising cisterns. But we're the things in motion, materializing, arriving on the scene with reporters. There is so much traffic at the hospital, they drape the window until evening. She is holding a hidden god in her arms. We can clearly see he is just suggesting himself. He is hidden in the world, so too in humans. But we want to find, to delight in the moist image, to depend on it. A surgeon stares into the viscera. A radiologist peers at a spot. We must make way for the cutting and healing. No matter, during off hours, we stare at the curtain. I'm going to read a poem now called Monuments. And I've had the chance to read this a couple of times. I like the story it tells. The figure in this poem of Kata Kollwitz, my wife trained as an art historian, and then she became a studio artist. And years ago, I got a review copy of the letters and diaries of Kata Kollwitz, and it promptly went up on the shelf. Nancy told me for years, open up and read this book. I finally did, and when I did, I was just amazed by her and her work. And I know that the school is very strong in art, so probably there are people here who have studied her, but she's in the poem. Her oldest son died in the first major battle of World War I at Ypres in Flanders. And that's in the poem. She commemorated his death by creating two monuments, a mother and a father, which stand at the entrance of the cemetery where he is buried there near Ypres. This poem is based on this, and it's called Monuments. The green of an ancient ginkgo outside the window of my hotel room, the shaping pleasure of it is a kind of stupefaction and forgetfulness. Some savior worried it from China to Belgium, signifying an unfulfilled mission, and then selected an auspicious site in 1730. This congeries of shadings does nothing for the imagination, but the mass of the tree, this is more like a truth, a full measure only now possible to weigh, a waste of years only now known. After millions died in the trenches, there was a resurrection of symbols, a flaring up of language for mourning. On November 11th at 11 a.m., the British would observe a 2-minute silence, moment of armistice, seconds running out on a squalid peace, memory like transpiration rising into gray currents above the channel. And the monuments, two figures of stone at the German war cemetery at Rogovelde, on their knees, the father hugging himself, the robed mother's arms wrapping her body, people of penumbral grays and too much caring. Some critic called Kata Kollwitz a narcissist for using her own countenance where meaning was heaviest and obvious, and finding only one emotion there, ever, the etched self-portraits becoming more somber until at the end she looked away from the living, became monumental. She who opened a fatal breach for her son, betrayed by a sense of calling. The corrupt world calling from a pocked field 20 kilometers northeast of Ypres, 10 days after waving goodbye. In her diary, the naturalistic folds disgust me, and the stylized folds disgust me. Only the silhouette matters, more technique than I possess. Detail accumulates. Restorations appear everywhere, but the sites of memory somehow diminish. The French called their disabled men gueules cassées, broken faces, horrifically hurt. They performed as shunted sites of memory, immovable when encountered, chiseled. When the next war began, November 11th meant nothing. When it was over, my mother steamed artichokes. On Saturday, sat deafened under a hairdryer, then wept on Sunday watching documentaries. I began a long, unsuccessful attempt to live a life in secret, with a fatal threat of my own making. Only in safety can one be so free and meticulous in selecting one's demons. Thus I'm reminded why I abandoned art, disgusted with my imagination. It occurred to Kollwitz suddenly, her face would be the face of the mother. The body would be trust in grief. We would be fictive kin to her gesture. To nurse a sapling, westbound and eager for renewal, to take all necessary steps, make the pilgrimage, and then fail to achieve the inner experience. There is only dexterity where I wanted firmness. To forbid the leafing colors of emotion until one's face is stone. I should have told you that my mother's side of the family is where I get my sense of history. My mother's family lived through the war in France and hid from the Germans. Miraculously, at the end of the war, they all went back to Paris, and they all survived, with the exception of one person who was taken to Auschwitz. So I lived with that as a kid, and I remember when I was a kid, my two closest buddies were Joey O'Brien, who was in the Filching poem that I read, another fellow whose last name is Lombardo, Irish and Italian, both Catholic. very close friends, and I remember my mother saying to me one day, they may be friends of yours, but would they save your life? And I thought that this was just overdoing it a little bit. It was just Joey and Mark, you know. We were playing soldiers in the backyard. But I came to understand, as the years went by, exactly what she meant by saving a life, and expanded on that idea, because it means not only allowing somebody to hide in your house, but also what it means to preserve your humanity in the face of things. That's my mother's side of the family. On my father's side of the family, there was also a tragedy and a catastrophe which colored my growing up. My grandmother died in a fire in Boston, the Coconut Grove fire of 1942. 492 people died as a result of the fire, many in the weeks afterwards from asphyxiation and so forth. And I grew up constantly hearing that if my grandmother had survived that fire, that our family would be different. And I wrote this poem, I wrote an early version of this poem back in the 70s and just went back to the whole topic and wrote a completely different thing after 9/11. This is called Coconut Grove. My life began with the fire, glimmering in the birth waters. Beyond my bedroom wall, voices murmured a memory. My father's mother died with her sister in the ladies' room. He said, nothing would be the way it is if she had escaped to Shawmut Street, been saved. In this way, how is it? Palled and quenched my days. I stared at a wire service photo fixed with brutal light, a fire hose snaking through soaked debris, faces slack with shock, abandoned by unbelief. How compelling for a family to have such a story to relate. Nothing would be the way it is. To speak of a desirable world, the listening boy leaning in. November in Boston, women collapsed waiting for their coats. The ceiling's satinette billows crackled and melted and were drawn into their throats. A shoe wedged in the revolving door. A face pressed against glass. The fireball, bright orange, or bluish with a yellow cast, or a blistering white. The nightclub burned in minutes in 1942 with a sibilant exhalation. My grandfather, sworn in, testified, but a single night evades judgment, bloated with unassignable blame. Over many nights of remembrance, we adored the damaged world, but we abused it. We refused to let the sea wind clear the smoke. Corrosive worm of remembrance, allure of the lurid past, the nozzle's snout regressing down the smoldering street. Now it is time to move within spaces on the sites of catastrophe. Our purest gaze in the atria and the lobbies, even as the alarms sound, evacuations rehearsed, the streets filling with imaginary survivors. Just as the boy survived boyhood, sleep settling on him like asbestos. Overtaken by events, what did the boy do? Struck matches, set fire to the fence next door, concealed himself and listened for the sirens. I think we mythologize our lives. We look back and then we try to figure out what it meant, and poetry's answers are partial and ambivalent. Poetry finds joy in that kind of response, in not finding answers but getting a feel for what happened. Lately I've been writing poems that try to pick apart and explain to myself. I'm 56 years old and didn't write for a long time, so essentially I have to account for myself. that's what I'm doing now. I think I'll read this poem first. This poem is called Morbidezza, and morbidezza is a word, it's a painterly word that describes a certain delicate way of rendering the flesh in oils. Morbidezza. I was proud of my prudence. When the goddess emerges, gazing straight ahead while descending the stone steps, you don't reach out to touch her. In my studio, in ink and lead, I studied her flesh solemnly, toiling like a cartographer's apprentice, tracing rivers, ranges, and borders. My pregnant wife didn't care for such imagery. She suspected this absorption in absent powers, a dispassionate alertness for some fascinating presence, some face. I rose from my chair, left my desk, and abjured the art for 20 years. I took a job, traveled alone, traveled often, alone. Returning, I discovered a daughter, then another, then again. Sometimes gashes and cuts, weeping, I would clean out their wounds. Sometimes I touched the hair, the backs of knees, shoulder blades. Then a car drove me to the airport. When I returned, they kissed me noisily. My wife's voice in the shape of my mouth. They smelled my hair. They could not stop touching me. Something familiar in this. The coy eyes pleading and at times deceitful. The bodies emerging. Unlike the resume, the soul is structured without a scheme or reason. So the body compels conclusions. Where once I saw my wife's body standing between me and a specter, I now stood pitched between my wife and the sun-tanned backs of my departing daughters. Into the dimly lit space, billowing with their absent scents, their calves and ankles, I now ask, what is the wish for love a wish for? Once again, I rise from my chair, leave my desk, and stand between my wife and all the voices together replying, our flesh is here for you. A world is here for you, only for you, just beyond your reach. Waxing gibbous, a phase of the moon. Waxing gibbous. The answering world took the form of a new country. The question was, will we continue to be hunted? The stalking enemy had withdrawn. How startling, such powerful intentions simply depart, throw off their uniforms. This is your moon, this is your sea, said my grandfather, lighting a Chesterfield. We were sitting on the wall at Wollaston Beach. My grandmother recalled, the youngest of the soldiers began to weep. Her soup reminded him of something. Five of them searching for weapons. When they left, she kept the food warm for the underground, hiding below the farm. It happened like this. It happened like this. It was crucial to remember everything together, 10 years after, and still weeping. So as a boy, I could not avoid seeing my mother as a girl, tumbling off her bicycle into a roadside ditch, the road strafed. My mother as a mother, singing with Ella when I returned from grade school for lunch. And later, in her bed, calling my grandparents to save her. I played records in my bedroom. Here is my grandfather's voice quoting Hikmet in Turkish. Then again, you must grieve for this right now. You have to feel this sorrow now. Suddenly, she stopped weeping. She spooned the soup on a tray. This is what happened. He lit another cigarette. We watched for our satellite. There was a gibbous moon so bright, I was frightened to be found. My accumulating moon, the shape on the morning of my birth, very nearly full, rising when few are watching, unnoticed until the hood of sunset, at times easily mistaken for something complete. My grandfather was born in Constantinople, now in Istanbul, in 1902, and one of his boyhood friends was the poet Hikmet. Now, my grandfather was a Jew, and Hikmet was a Turk, but at the time, the Germans were in Turkey, and the two of them went to a German school. In fact, Hikmet's father became the consul to Hamburg. So my grandfather spoke fluent German. He spoke seven languages. He was caught by the Vichy in French, and he was thrown into a detention camp. The Vichy were a bit disorganized. He was thrown into a camp, and yet he was given passes to go north to see his family every so often, and then he would come back. Otherwise, they would just track him down again. And I thought it would have been very easy for the Vichy then simply to follow my grandfather to where the rest of the family was hiding, but it didn't occur to them, I guess. He told me that he lived through the war with this volume of Hikmet's poetry. Now, Hikmet also was a socialist, and my grandfather was a raging Democrat. To him, Adlai Stevenson was God. The Republicans were the people who were going to take away his Medicare, that's all he cared about when he came here. So he lived with this volume of poetry of Hikmet, and he would read to me in Turkish, and then he would translate it, and I think that it's the first poetry I heard. Which is kind of odd because, you know, these are not poems in our tradition, so to speak, but they're wonderful poems. And I think the first poet I really heard was Yeats in high school, hearing the sound of the language. But the moment I thought I might like to be a poet was when I was in college and I was taking a Stevens seminar. The campus poets would come in, one in each class. They would come in and they would read a poem by Stevens, and then the seminar would continue. One day, James Tate, who at that point was a very young poet, it was 1969, came in. He didn't read, he recited The Man on the Dump. And I thought that was just the most amazing thing, and thought, I just really would like to do that. I'd like to be a person who could get up in front of people and recite a poem like The Man on the Dump. This poem is called Strophe. Many of my poet heroes are international poets. One of them is George Seferis. George Seferis was a lifelong Greek diplomat, ultimately became the Greek ambassador to the court of St. James after World War II, and always felt this tension between his career, which was very demanding and very tragic because the history of Greece in the 20th century is monstrous, and the desire to be a poet and to spend time writing. And when he went up to London, he finally got to meet T.S. Eliot, and as poets always complain, you know, about not having enough time to write, he went to Eliot to complain. He said, I just don't have so much time to write. And of course, Eliot knew what it meant to have a job since he had been a banker. Now he was an editor at Faber. And Eliot said, no. You must have some other way to be preoccupied. You must have a job because poetry comes out of the unconscious. He took note of that. It made him feel a little bit better. Seferis is a hero to me because he managed to sustain his ability to create and still to relate to his times. He wrote a book called Strophe. When he used the word strophe, he meant it as a turning point, and sort of as an homage to him, I call my poem Strophe. Far out on an island in the harbor, recruits rehearsed in burning rooms. We could see the training tower flaming like a floating candle, even at noon. There are other islands, some barren, some with remains of old use. Of course, the burning spectacle drew my attention, apt to dissolve in the sea, lulled by the sound of waves, both imperative and dull. Pessoa wrote, "Even if you sail across every sea, all you learn is the breadth of your own boredom." Without the plume of smoke, the ocean blurs to abstraction. Without the chance of rescue from what rages with the heat of saving certainties, I have no real life. Avid intimacies of murmurous waves also arrange a miracle, but one I no longer trust. When a fireman dies on the job, usually the heart fails. So they practice technique in a simulated six-story elevator shaft. All around them, but unable to distract, A tide surges below their six-hour session of discipline and skill, and a nimbus of fuming haze hovers above the tower. What do I praise? Not the summons of the shore, impassive to our knowledge and disillusion. Not the dank drafts of an old fort decaying on another island. But a moment, while we sat on the seawall, talking of our times, unprepared to interpret, distracted by what we noticed, something ignited for fighters to withstand, and recruits repelled with deadweight dummies. I think I'll read one more poem, and this poem is called The Great Wave. You remember the tsunami? A flood is both an abundance and a catastrophe at the same time. This is one of those poems where I've read it a couple of times. It's one of these where the voice is not exactly my voice, but I heard it as my voice when I was working. In other words, this character is watching TV, and he sees the imagery that we all saw, you know, the constant media images of the tsunami. And it's called The Great Wave. I predict, as one who was sucked to sea and returned in an Arabian container ship, all small worlds will be dashed and drowned. Take your sabbatical and suitcase. Study the high water marks on the walls and tell us what you've learned of the earth. I witnessed this deliverance on a silent television. My fingers disquieted a bowl of almonds. A librarian called to say, Constantinople is on hold. The entire surface trembled, an oscillation like a bell. When the seismologist said the Eurasian plate delivered a blow to our planet, his words came from a time when we still believed in the Earth's roundness. The tidal sugars and salts of our bodies, the atonement of death camp commandants. But the planet does the delivering at 9 a.m. with Sharia police patrolling the shaking streets and the shrouded wave gathering speed. When I was a child, I discovered my depravity among the other boys, but we were sanguine all the same, with the fortitude to face what we'd found. But now it hurts to hold the human in the mind. It hurts to abandon the world for the addictive news of the world's moments. I didn't realize the floodwaters would recede with the violence of their rising. Fishing boats torn from moorings, dome of the mosque collapsed. You who savor the scent of the linden live in a small world, and I also speak from a cramped provisional space. On the stacked ship, they videotaped as they passed, then circled back to pluck a single man from floating debris. I witnessed this alone on a glowing screen. I couldn't lift an almond to my mouth. I was a fallow field ruined by brackish flood. But I would choose the wave over the wind. I would swamp your world with wreckage. I would hold fast to you, and you would be saved. Thank you, everyone, for coming out tonight in the rain and so forth.